Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And like they say on Star Wars, we are at 94.
Docking Bay 94.
Yes, minute 94. And we're joining Captain America already in progress. Hal, tell us what's going on in this particular minute.
A lot of action and no talking. It's an interesting one. Captain America roars up a concrete ramp on his motorcycle, soaring into the Hydra motor pool. Futuristic tanks and trucks loom in the yard as he lands, swerving to dodge blue energy bolts fired by Hydra soldiers. He flips a final switch on his bike's weapons panel, leaps off, and rolls clear as more bolts streak past. Steve hurls his vibranium shield, knocking a soldier off a tank's turret. Then, flipping onto his back, he stands and flings the shield again, dropping another soldier. The shield ricochets back into his hand with a metallic clang. His unmanned motorcycle slams into the Hydra entrance, exploding in a fiery blast that sends troops inside tumbling. Steve charges forward, his shield a blur as he smashes through Hydra soldiers, toppling them like bowling pins. He bounces the shield off one soldier's chest, then grabs another, hurling him over a tank with ease. Catching his shield, Steve suddenly finds himself trapped as two Hydra soldiers unleash streams of fire from flamethrowers, encircling him in a ring of flames. Dozens more soldiers close in, their blue energy weapons glowing ominously. Two Hydra soldiers march a captured Captain America into the Red Skull's office.
I know I was a little florid with the description there, but that's what it felt like.
That's exactly right.
If this were a comic book, you could almost see the parentheses stretching out from the sides of the shield as it was ricocheting off all the tanks and stuff.
That's my note on this episode. You know, I prepare notes for this, and my first note is just a big capital wow at the top of the page. This is a comic book come to life in a way that movies very rarely achieve. This is Captain America. This is what I want to see. It's him with the shield ricocheting impossibly off of weird angles and not decapitating anybody, which it really ought to be doing by all rights. But this is just a wonderful scene. I love seeing Captain America in action. It's the 7-year-old boy in me come to life. I really love this.
Yeah, yeah. Likewise. And yeah, it's funny talking about the shield and the ricochets and things. I liken it a little bit to, you know, some of the first times we saw really, really good live action Spider-Man on screen.
Yeah.
That when you get these superhero physics that, you know, you suspend a bit of disbelief, but they establish these parameters. Like, this is what Spider-Man looks like when he swings, and he can go forever through Manhattan by shooting the webs and using that energy. And it's very satisfying to watch, and it moves perhaps not as it would, but just how you want it to. And I see the same thing with the shield. He flings that shield, it bounces off, and it never feels to me like it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know, if we sat down and plotted it out, we'd probably find ways, well, that would, maybe it wouldn't fly exactly like that or do that, but it in a way, it's somehow, it's like, it's visually, we've established the rules for how this shield is going to move, and then it moves with respect to those rules in ways you want it to.
I like you mentioned of physics, and I like you mentioned of Spider-Man, because what these filmmakers had to do in all these Marvel movies is look at the comics where these characters do literally impossible things and figure out how to make them look probable or you know, reasonable. And Spider-Man is a good example, because what they did for the movies with Spider-Man is they made his webs a little elastic so we could shoot it and pull it, and it's like a bungee cord that springs up the air. That was never in the comics. We had no idea how Spider-Man got up to the 42nd floor of these skyscrapers, but they did that for the comics, and they did this for the movies. And they did similar things with Captain America in this movie, that it looks so good, so it feels right. It's probably not, if you did some kind of, you know, vector analysis of this thing, it wouldn't work at all, but it feels exactly like it ought to feel. I love that.
And it feels like Captain America knows He's almost like a billiard player. He knows how to do a three-corner shot, and he's anticipating what he's going to do next with the shield. You can feel his sense of, I know how this thing works. And the shield is almost like an extension of his own body. He just imparts energy to it, bouncing off of whoever he needs it to hit, and it'll come right back to him like a boomerang. Just how you want to see it.
Just in time to block a blue bolt from somebody.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
I had a thought, if you don't mind me exploring this a little bit. I think it's easier to portray someone much more powerful than this, like a Thor or a Hulk or a Superman, than it is someone like Cap, who functions in a realm we can just imagine and physics we're more familiar with. And if an example of this is, we've talked about the comic book writer and artist John Byrne before. John Byrne had an interesting point about the very first Christopher Reeve Superman movie, that the point when audiences gasp in his experience was at the very end when Superman rips the door off Lois Lane's car. It's not when he's lifting up the, San Andreas fault. It's when he rips the door off the car, because we can all imagine what it would be like to rip the door off a car.
Right.
I have no concept of the forces involved in lifting up an earthquake fault line. I can imagine what it'd be like to rip a door off a car. And similarly, in the Henry Cavill Superman movie, Man of Steel, there's a scene where he just snaps handcuffs like it's wet spaghetti. The army has deigned to handcuff him, and when he feels like it, he just goes snap and he's free. That's a startling moment to both the characters in the movie and us moviegoers. I think it's much more interesting and effective as a show of his strength than watching him catch a 747 or something. So these kind of human scale feats of strength at which Captain America works at, I think, are harder to portray and maybe more impactful to an audience than, watching Superman move planets.
It's also it. I think it's one of those philosophical things. The fellow that we had on that was discussing Marvel and heroics and the gods. He's showing the Aristotelian idea of Aristotle's idea of what good is, and it's showing incredible power, but the ability to harness that power only for, altruistic or positive uses. Red Skull has the same powers as Captain America, but he's misusing them, not for good. And I think being able to see that strength and control, it underlines the classic idea that we have. I mean, and classic going back to the Odyssey of how what is good and what is evil. It's showing that he has this kind of control over massive forces, but he chooses not to use them for bad purposes or for selfish reasons.
Those are excellent points, and something that when you were talking, Brian, something really came into my mind along those lines. And I think we've talked about this before, is superhero movies, and I understand why this happens. They will start to lose me a little bit when the hero has met his match. But I mean, of course, for a story, he or she has to meet their match. But when I see a Superman movie, I love a scene where somebody's going to try to mug Clark Kent, and maybe they shoot and the bullet bounces off, and it's like, we know it and they don't, and it's because it's that human level, as you were saying, Brian, and then Jim, of course, using the powers for good, but it's underscoring, it's reminding me of why this superhero is super. Is it Man of Steel where there's the big just sort of boxing match between Superman and Zod in the city, and it's big, it's spectacular, it's well done, and it's overall it's a movie I enjoy, but honestly, that the giant spectacle gets a little ho-hum for me. I'm punching you, you're punching me, it's two guys punching, they just both happen to be way stronger than me. But I like being reminded of the difference in the abilities, but in a way that's relatable, as you said. I'm gonna seal the San Andreas fault or what have you. I don't know, but yeah, ripping a door off a car, which I've done with hydraulic tools, but never with my bare hands, for the record.
That's right. You're trained. You're trained
Practice, practice, practice. Yeah, but
Yes.
yeah. What you're saying, and the Henry Cavill one, it had the flaws that I saw in it was, that's not Superman would not be punching. He'd be going out trying to rescue everybody falling out of the buildings that are coming down around him. And I think that's bothered me in the, I'd say after about the mid eight, maybe Death of Superman, after Death of Superman, having no compunctions against death. I mean, the classic Silver Age Superman was always, he'll hang up his cape if anybody dies on his, you know, on his account. And I think that's where a lot of the modern superhero movies, not this one, but a lot of the modern superhero movies, they don't understand that idea of having that moral center. And it also calls back to the idea of this is their personality. I mean, we've seen alternate universe, you know, like Red Sun, the one where what if Superman had landed in Soviet Russia instead of being Clark Kent? He was an apparatchik. So, you know, I think losing that idea of having the moral center is where modern superhero movies go off the rails. But this Captain America movie is not one of them.
Yeah, well, that's what makes something like the most recent Superman movie refreshing, is that the David Corn-Sweat Superman is it's got its own flaws, but he's just good through and through to the center. And it's right, like a breath of fresh air when that happens. And Captain America in this movie, I think, had the same effect. I mean, I love Robert Downey Jr. and Tony Stark, but Tony Stark is not a good character through and through. You know, he's a very flawed character. And so this Steve Rogers is an interesting contrast to him, and I think a good one to remind us of. These are, you know, a superhero doesn't have to be, but can be just a good person doing the right things for the right reason.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. There's also been the rise of the anti-hero, you know, where people just love to watch grim and gritty superheroes, or not even superheroes, people would be considered villains, like
Walter White, maybe. Yeah.
Walter White. I was thinking of in superhero terms, Venom. There's been a lot of Venom movies. Venom's just a straight up villain, man. He just kills and eats people, and audiences love him. I don't get it. I don't like it. You know, you touched on the Cavill Superman movie. In my opinion, Henry Cavill is the best looking Superman that's ever been put on film, even better looking than Chris Reeve, in my opinion. But boy, he was poorly served by that script. He's never had a good script, and I wish he'd had one.
Yeah. No, he's a fantastic actor. It's just getting the words out of his mouth the right way. It seems to go nowhere.
Starting with the right words.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're not here to talk about Superman.
No, no, no. That's our next podcast, if you'll. No, it isn't. Please, no.
Chris Evans is just perfect in this part and brings the sincerity to this character that works. It's just, he's a pure-hearted character who remains interesting. He never becomes boring for his pure-heartedness.
Now, we'll get into this in a future minute, but is Captain America allowing himself to be captured here? Is this the plot that he wants to get inside?
I was wondering the same thing. We will learn in future minutes whether it is or not. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Well, remember, his plan was to, you know, knock on the front door.
Mission
accomplished with the motorcycle and things. And, you know, there's two guys come up to him with the flamethrowers, and, you know, somewhere Johnny Cash is singing about a ring of fire. It always comes to my mind in that scene. It's, you know, he could take those guys, I think.
Yeah, without he could take trouble. The 50 other guys who show up.
Yeah, the 50 other guys that then show up.
It's a clever shot with a shield, though.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. A super bank shot, and
boing,
you know,
boing.
Or you pick up one of the flamethrower guys and throw him at a bunch of the others, and he blows up or whatever.
I think it has to. Maybe not specific time and place. Like, he might have wanted to get a little further into the compound before he got captured. But I think he knew he was going to get captured.
Right, and then he's got his wits and his strength to get himself out. But it's also a good scene to distress what we kind of started the episode talking about, is that, you know, Cap has powers. You know, we can't have, but we can imagine. You know, we understand. He's an understandable amount stronger than us, but when we're looking down and he's got the two flamethrower guys and the other 50 guys circle around him, it's like, okay, the audience will accept that this is a limit to what he could really do.
And although yes. I still can't believe Hydra was stupid enough to send him to the Red Skull with two guards. Two guards. Right. You know, those two guys. Now, to answer your earlier question, if Cap wanted to get away from those two guards, piece of cake.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, no, he's this is the fastest way to get to Red Skull directly.
Yeah.
So, but he, the other thing I'm wondering, a couple of episodes ago, we talked about when they're all sitting around at the meeting talking about how they're going to do the knock on the front door. They mentioned that Red Skull's headquarters, his final, you know, his last factory is 500 feet underground. How is there a window 500 feet under? I'm just trying to, are they measuring 500 feet from the top of the Alps? Or I just couldn't figure out where that window came from at the very end of this minute.
At the very end? I got to scrub.
It's the longest skylight ever.
Yeah.
It's just one big sky tunnel.
Yeah, like those solar tubes that were popular about 30 years ago. Yeah.
Oh, I've got some. I love them. They're wonderful. Yeah. 500 foot solar tube.
Wow.
Good question. I don't know. Maybe the set designers weren't talking to the writers at this point.
Yeah.
And we're sure it's not just a big Klieg light or something that's up there that's causing that. I mean, it's such a different color temperature than the.
There is a window on.
Where do we see the window?
Hang on a second. Let me. I've got my sound on. Sorry about that. It is right at the end.
Oh, there it is. Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like at the
just
very
last
second. Just
before the close-up.
And that window's going to take an important role in the next few minutes. Right. So it just, I don't know. Maybe they just have, it goes into the mountain and then you go down to go to the factory and up to go to the headquarters and also the aircraft hangar.
This could be an antechamber of some sort because the aircraft got to get out too.
Yeah.
That's maybe true. Just the lab stuff is underground. I got to tell you guys, I had the experience, the delight one time of going to a compound, not unlike this one, underground. It's called the Helms Pump Storage Project. And it's built into a mountain in the Sierra Nevada, east of Fresno, California. And the idea, it was built by our utility, PG&E, to generate electricity by tapping water flow from a high lake to a lower lake. And this place was situated in the mountain right between the lakes. And so you go through a half mile long tunnel just to get to the powerhouse. And you get inside this thing, and it looks like a James Bond lair combined with the inside of Hoover Dam. You feel the floors rumble and rattle. It was incredible. And the way a pump storage project works is in daytime when electricity has value, when it's expensive, you generate electricity by flowing water from the upper lake to the bottom, to the lower lake. At nighttime, when electricity is cheap, you pump the water back uphill. So it's a battery.
It's a real big battery. Yeah, a liquid battery. Yeah.
And so I got a tour of this place once, and it kind of reminds me of this, except it did not have any windows 500 feet underground, but there were windows in structures leading to 500 feet underground, you know? So it's the whole thing wasn't underground, but, and maybe that's where we're at here is just, you know, the lobby. Maybe we're in the lobby.
That could be, yeah. The lobby. The entrance to where the elevator is to take you down. Right.
You got
to
check in with the security guard. Yeah. Here's the Red Skull.
No,
I do not have an appointment.
Captain America calling for the Red Skull.
Yes.
On our previous show for the October Sky Minute, we had a fellow from Stratica, which is a salt mine in the middle of Hutchinson, Kansas. And they have a 500-foot deep mine that you ride down in the elevator in total darkness. And the tour guide that was on the thing, we're all wearing miner's helmets as is required. As we're going down 500 feet, she says, you know, most people don't experience total darkness. There's always a light or something, but this is going to be one of the few times in your life that you're going to experience absolute total darkness. And then she turned the light off. And it was the most, you're deep in the earth, but it's the most unearthly feeling as you suddenly you rely a lot on your eyesight to spot which way is up. And it just becomes this endless void. And all you're hearing is the machinery humming until you get to the bottom floor. I can recommend the experience, but not for the faint of heart.
I've experienced that in caves before. When you're deep in a cave and they turn off the lights and it's the darkness is like a thing. It's like an oppressive force upon you. Really interesting experience.
Yeah, it's much less than the much more rather than the absence of light at that point.
Yeah, it's spooky.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, I'm not exactly sure what else to chat about with this, unless let's say a fond farewell to that poor motorcycle. That was a great it was a great machine while it lasted, and hopefully it was made out of cardboard.
I'm gonna stand by my wow for this minute, because it's just it's straight up Captain America action right out of the comic books, like Jack Kirby drew it himself. It's just so well done. So congrats to Joe Johnston, the stunt teams, Chris Evans, everybody who had anything to do with this, because this is what I wanted to see since I was a child.
Yeah, flying dirt and sparks. That's the way it goes.
So I do have one quick question for you guys at around, say, starting at second 53, 54. So Cap's captured and he's being escorted in, and it's the longer shot as he's walking in under the archway, escorted by the guards. There's some things there on casters, these big canisters on wheels that, like, if you didn't see the wheels at the bottom, they'd almost look like legs, like these things could walk around. Any thoughts as to what those might be? Are they stills?
I was thinking they were like stills or some kind of mash tun for brewing. We are in Germany, so it might be just a small,
I see what you're saying. They look like they're like little robot legs.
They look like robot legs.
I used to work in the labs, and we had a lot of compressed gases and things that looked like that. A lot of argon and nitrogen and big 6 foot tall doers that looked like that. But not with the legs. Those legs are funky, man. They look like they should walk. They look like droids from Star Wars.
Yeah, they really do. If you look closely enough, you see their wheels at the bottom, and maybe castering. Maybe it's a portable still. Maybe we're already brewing vats of Red Skull's Victory Lager.
Schnapps.
More schnapps. Yeah, just for the returning flight. I do appreciate that square it's tall stool by the drafting table. I think everybody at one point in their life has owned one of those things, and they usually wind up in the garage because they're so uncomfortable to sit on. But you do need to be like that height when you're working on something that's exactly about 3 to 4 feet tall.
Oh God, right. I didn't notice that. That's so hilarious. In this high tech retro futuristic, lab manufacturing plant, there's an old wooden drafting table sitting there. That's hilarious. Yeah, I love that.
That was a great catch. In the Pacific Northwest, like sort of a cousin to that stool is the infamous Boeing metal desk. And, we had a big Boeing surplus outlet out there, and then these things just turned up. And at some point, everybody just had one. Like if you lived in that area long enough, suddenly there would be one in your basement. Maybe that's where your copy of the LP Frampton Comes Alive was resting. That was also required ownership like in the late 70s. But these desks, and everybody had them because they were indestructible and they were insanely heavy. So a simple desk with just two or three drawers, I think just on the one side, maybe on the left side. And, whatever that sort of, looks like wood from 20 feet away, Formica top. But I swear this little thing, I don't know if it would have been, maybe 4 feet by 2 feet. Those things weighed 300 pounds. Yep. They were just absolutely unbelievably heavy. So somehow one finds its way into your life. You're never moving with it. It's staying behind, and then off you go on to your next thing. And they must have been selling them off for 25 cents at the big Boeing surplus place or something. It's like, well, that's a good desk, that'll last forever. That is absolutely true.
Just you never had to haul it again. I do like the I tend to think of it as the OSHA and EEOC mandatory paperwork for Red Skull that's hanging on their bulletin board of all the different there's a bunch of different what look like official looking pieces of paper stuck on the bulletin board above the drafting table.
Just to the right of the
it just looks like know
table.
Your rights, you have none. This is the Red Skull Hydra. Hail Hydra.
You are entitled to a half hour lunch break.
Yeah. Right. minimum wage is nothing and like it.
Be lucky you're not vaporized.
Right. Yes.
Wow, but what a it's a fun glimpse into the life of henchery. Right. Wow. Well, this has been a very fun episode. Surprisingly so, considering, as you said, Hal, no dialogue. We've got a lot more. Well, actually, not a lot more. We're running out of episodes, so keep hanging in with us. If you would like to continue the conversation, though, we are always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base over on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
Can do this all day.